All right, you're on the line with Mark Young from markyoungtrainingsystems.com, and today we're talking with Lyle McDonald. Lyle, do you want to just sort of give people a little bit of a background about yourself for people who may not know too much about you?
Sure. I kind of got into this field almost kind of by accident. I basically grew up in, I'll spare you the long torturous story, but I grew up as sort of a typical middle-class American kid living on bologna and cheese sandwiches, Fritos, and Little Debbie snack cakes. And no activity, a lot of video games, was always kind of a chunky little kid. Got to high school where we had mandatory athletics, and that's kind of where I got into sports. I got into martial arts, swimming, cycling, and as I sort of started to see some physical changes, I kind of liked it, and I got into this field through that. That led me to UCLA, where I studied exercise physiology, got into some competitive cycling, inline skating, which just kind of drove me further into this field. I was, like most people, wanted to be a better athlete than I was, and saw all the supplements and all the claims, and started researching everything at the medical library, and realized that most of it was a lot of garbage. That just kind of brought me through, and now jump forward into my 20s. My real background was in exercise physiology, but I started getting more interested in nutrition through a diet that a steroid guru named Dan Duchesne had come up with called the Body Opus Diet. And the long and the short of it was that led me to write my first book on low-carbohydrate diets. And since that time, I've just been sort of involved in nutrition, exercise physiology, performance, pretty much anything that's involved with either fat loss, training, nutrition, supplements, I'm interested. Most of it was through my own interest and desire to be both lean and a better athlete, and I've just kind of managed to turn that into a career one way or another.
That's pretty cool, actually. So I guess you're kind of known in the fitness industry for not pulling any punches, and so I guess the first thing I'd like to lead off with is, what are some of the biggest misconceptions, or do you think is the biggest bunch of nonsense with regards to fat loss? Is there anything that really stands out in your mind?
Probably, I think the biggest one, and this is one of those things that will come through diet books and the fat loss field, you know, it'll make a run every decade or so, is this idea that it's not the calories, it's the quality of the food. And I kind of joke that all diet books will tell you that you don't have to count calories to lose weight or fat, and then they'll trick you into doing it anyway. Most diet books, through one form or another, will get people to reduce calories without having to really think about it after they've told them endlessly that it's not about calories. So I'd say that's probably the biggest one. And you see that one a lot of the low-carbohydrate literature, that it's not calories that make you fat, it's carbohydrates or it's insulin. And it's true in that when you get people to stop eating all carbohydrates, they typically eat less. So, of course, they lose weight, but it's because they're eating less calories. It's not because of the carbohydrates per se. We all know plenty of athletes, bodybuilders, folks who get plenty lean on carbohydrate-based diets. So clearly it's not the carbs and it's not the insulin. So I think that's the biggest one that really bugs me. Yeah.
Okay, now, so in saying that you're not really buying into the type of food, are you saying theoretically that you could get just as lean eating 100% Oreo diet as you could on a clean food diet?
No. And that's, people tend to kind of misconstrue some of what I say as saying that. There's definitely, when you start to look at all the literature, and I've been reading all of it for over 10 years now, clearly certain food patterns are superior to others. And I think the biggest one that's shown up in the research, and of course bodybuilders and athletes have known this for 30 years, is that almost without exception, diets with higher protein are superior to diets with lower protein. That's pretty much unquestionable now, and there's a number of different mechanisms. First and foremost, higher dietary protein tends to blunt appetite, and several studies have shown that if you get people to simply increase their protein intake, they tend to eat less. Of more importance is diets that have inadequate protein, and there's a lot of them out there, do tend to cause more muscle loss, which means less fat loss and, of course, less favorable changes in body composition. So when I say that it's not necessarily the source of the calories, there are some caveats on that. And the first one is that people have to be getting adequate protein in the first place. So some of the extreme examples that I see, people will always bring up the, oh, so 100% table sugar is worse than chicken breast and broccoli. Well, you changed two major things there. You're not just talking about the quality of the food, you're talking completely about the macronutrient composition. So yeah, people have to get adequate protein. They also have to get adequate essential fatty acids. I'm sure your listeners have heard about the fish oils, and there's no doubt that they do just about everything good, and everyone should take them, and there's no debate about that. What I generally find is that once protein and essential fatty acid requirements are filled, the rest of the diet will make much less of a difference. From a fat loss standpoint, now clearly from a health standpoint, you're better off eating less refined foods, higher fiber, more vitamins and minerals, all of those sorts of things. I'm not going to argue about that or try to tell you that eating junk food is better than eating, you know, quote unquote, clean food. From a fat loss standpoint, assuming the calories are the same, the differences aren't nearly as massive as most people make out. Now, it will start to matter, you know, when people start to try to get to single-digit body fat percentages, these things do start to matter too. What I find is that a lot of people who are, you know, contest dieting, super lean bodybuilders, forget that they are a very small percentage of the actual weight loss field. Part of the reason that I tend to be a little bit more relaxed about some of these things is when you're dealing with the general public, trying to get them into those intense, obsessive, compulsive, you know, damn near eating disorder bodybuilder type approaches can be as harmful as it is good. Trying to get someone to completely change their eating habits from what they've been doing to that type of approach is often just such a jump that people figure, well, I can't do this, why bother? So a lot of it, what answer I give will depend on what population I'm talking to. If I'm trying to diet someone down to 5%, I'll be a whole lot more concerned about the quality of the food. If someone's just trying to get started with losing weight, it's more important that they make some changes, that they get everything perfect. And I realize I'm kind of going off on a tangent about this. But back to your original question. Does food quality matter? Yes, up to a point. Absolutely. Does it matter as, you know, does your diet have to be 100% clean or you'll never ever reach your goals? I don't think so. Over the decades, bodybuilders have gotten lean on any different diet you can care to name, and the commonalities are that they keep reduced calories and they stick with it for the months it takes them to get lean. If it were a specific type of food required, I don't think you'd see that happening.
So that's definitely a good point, too, because obviously what you're able to get away with depends on where you are on the...
Yes, on the very diet. Much so. It's kind of one added comment I would make as far as the food quality thing, because people may misinterpret what I'm saying, is there has been also a tremendous amount of research of late that for people with severe insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome, syndrome X, whatever you want to call it, definitely from a health standpoint and possibly from a body composition standpoint, lowering carbohydrates does seem to be beneficial. That is one specific situation where, you know, people ask, is one diet the best diet? And the answer is, well, there's a couple of answers. One is it depends on the person. You brought this up as, you know, what stage of leanness are they at? There's also an issue of activity. How much training are they doing? That determines what they should be eating. There's also an issue of insulin resistance, genetics. And again, people that are carrying more body fat are typically insulin resistant. They tend to do better by increasing protein, increasing dietary fat, and lowering dietary carbohydrates.
So would you say that for the bulk of the population, because I would say that the majority of people that I encounter anyways have some degree of insulin resistance or something, would you say for the majority of the population that would be the route to take, that lowering carbohydrates to some degree would be effective? Or
absolutely. One of the things that's, again, the short answer is yes, and the long answer is, with the possible, you know, most people I don't think need extremely high carbohydrate diets. The typical exception is extremely active athletes, and even that's typically endurance athletes. You know, our typical modern life, most people sit at a desk all day, if they exercise, they're not doing a staggering amount, and it's certainly not at a super high intensity. The carbohydrate requirements just aren't there. So I would rather see people end up at moderate carbohydrates as a starting point, moderate amounts of lean dietary protein, moderate amounts of fats, with the emphasis being on, you know, olive oil, healthier fats, fish oils, some saturated fats, you know, almost, you know, sort of Barry Sears as a zone type approach, I think would probably be more appropriate for the grand majority. And then some people will be at further extremes. Some people that have severe insulin resistance may have to completely remove carbohydrates. There's also some interest and some evidence that that people are literally carbohydrate addicts, that when they eat carbohydrates, they want to eat more carbohydrates, and of course that's going to make them eat too much food, and then they're going to gain weight. So in that situation, you may have to completely remove carbohydrates and go to more of a full-blown ketogenic, you know, Atkins protein power, South Beach, whatever kind of diet. And then when you've got extremely active athletes, they may need much higher carbohydrates than that. But it's kind of a generic one-size-fits-all kind of thing. Yeah, I agree completely. More of a moderated carb approach with plenty of lean protein, vegetables, fruits, and healthier fats would probably be a better approach for most than either extreme.
Okay, so you mentioned dietary protein for suppressing hunger and things like that. Do you have a general guideline that you would use with regards to grams per pound or grams per kilogram or something like that in the majority of your fat loss programs?
The way I actually do it now is, you know, bodybuilders have typically thrown out a value of, you know, 1 gram per pound of lean body mass. And for lean individuals who are training, that's a pretty reasonable value. You know, when people get real lean, I may go a little bit higher than that. What you do see is that people who are carrying more body fat and or not training quite as intensely don't have quite the same protein requirements. So I tend to scale protein requirements based on those two variables. Is as body fat percentage goes up, the amount of protein needed tends for all these benefits tends to go down, and vice versa. And then, of course, as activity levels go up, protein requirements go up a little bit. So depending, you know, and I sort of present this scheme in a couple of my different books. And so it can range from, you know, a low of possibly, you know, 0.7 to 0.8 grams per pound, which is in the range of 1.5 to 1.6 grams per kilo. It's a little bit more than that. I know you're in Canada. Lean athletes who are dieting hard may need 1.5 gram per pounds of lean body mass, you know, upwards of 3.3 grams per kilo. So it's somewhere in that range. And again, as body fat goes up, protein requirements go down. I do find that some people just feel better with higher protein intakes, even at higher body fat percentages. They find that blood sugar stays more stable. Again, protein tends to be the most filling nutrient of all of them, and that more than anything, I think, is beneficial on a diet. You know, this goes back to one of your earlier questions in a massive tangent I went on, which, you know, what's the best diet? And what most of the studies of late have shown is that the best one is the one you can stick to in the long term. And I've been saying this for years. You know, again, we can get into details if you've got a lean athlete, a lean bodybuilder trying to get to 5%. But for the general public, it's more of getting them to change their eating habits and stick with it in the long term. And for that, the best diet is the one that they'll actually stick to. A big part of that is people don't like being hungry. I don't like being hungry when I diet. You don't like being hungry when you diet. And that, as much as anything, tends to derail diets. Eating more lean protein helps with that. So I might start someone, you know, who's carrying a lot of body fat and not doing a lot of training. They may start at 0.7 to 0.8 grams per pound of lean body mass, and they may find that they actually do better with more protein than that, and I have no problem with that.
Now, you mentioned you're scaling your protein to their pounds of lean body mass versus their overall body mass. Is that an important distinction?
Yeah, it is. And again, you know, a lot of dieting ideas and subculture come out of the bodybuilding arena. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, as a group, that they're the ones that have probably been the most successful. But if you're looking at, say, a lean male bodybuilder at 10% body fat, his total weight and his lean body mass aren't that different. His lean body mass is 90% of his total body weight. In that case, using total body weight works just fine. But as body fat percentage goes up, clearly the difference between lean body mass and total body mass is going to start changing really significantly. If you've got someone who may be 300 pounds and 50% body fat, and that's not unheard of, they've only got 150 pounds of lean body mass. If you set protein intake recommendations to their total body weight, you end up at just such a ridiculous excess that it's really an unnecessary amount of protein. So I tend to, you know, researchers have in the past have used ideal body weight, usually based on some sort of BMI chart or estimation equations. What they're actually doing is trying to use lean body, or I'm sorry, use ideal body mass as a proxy for lean body mass. So it ends up kind of being the same, but I think you end up with more realistic dietary setups if you use lean body mass.
Okay, that definitely makes sense. So for the average person, I mean, do you think that the bioelectrical impedance, I mean, this seems to be the one that most people have access to. Do you think that getting lean body mass from bioelectrical impedance or the handheld or the stand-on scales are effective?
The thing with bioelectrical impedance is if you follow some pretty strict hydration protocols, it tends to be reasonably accurate. The problem is nobody does. And hydration can be so drastically affected by, you know, sodium intake, carbohydrate intake, training, day-to-day variance. I've seen people playing around with those things, and you know, they'll have a big glass of water, and it'll throw off body fat percentage by a couple points, and they'll be dehydrated, and they'll throw it off by a couple points. Now, this becomes really important, again, when you're dealing with leaner individuals and you're trying to get a really accurate measure of lean body mass or body fat percentage so you can estimate lean body mass. For the general overweight population, you're not going to get a super accurate measure almost no matter what you do. You know, most of the equations tend to fall apart at the extremes anyway. That if it'll put you in shooting distance, you're probably good enough. You know, a couple percentage points either way isn't going to be a huge difference. They are quick and easy. Most gyms have them, or you can get the ones at home. I do know some people who've used them pretty successfully, who focus primarily on consistency. And this is true for any measure you're going to make. And that might be something worth talking about, especially for the female people, females who are trying to lose weight, is if you always measure Monday morning, first thing, you're at least getting consistent measurement with the bioelectric impedance scales. You probably had a fairly similar weekend to the previous weekend. You might have gone out drinking or eaten a little bit more junk than you were supposed to or whatever it is. At least then you're consistent. What I find is people jump on them at the oddest times, and changes in hydration will really throw off the values and drive them absolutely crazy. So if you use them in a consistent fashion, they're probably good enough if you're talking about the sort of the general population. For leaner folks, I would prefer to find, you know, a better, somewhat more accurate method, whether it's calipers or something more technical like that.
Okay, so but for the general population, then, yeah, like a home-based scale would be suitable to set protein
sure
intakes.
Because again, it'll put you probably within shooting range, and that's all we're really looking for at this point.
Okay, so I just sort of want to pick your brain then about some. If you had, like, this is kind of, I know that a lot of things, there's a lot of variables that change, but what would be some of the concrete variables that don't change in a Lyle McDonald program? So, I mean, obviously carbohydrate intake is going to fluctuate, dietary fats might fluctuate, everything's going to change, but what would be some of the nutritional principles that you stand by consistently on all fat loss diets?
Well, the first one, and the one that's inarguable, is it has to create a caloric deficit. You know, again, I've been involved in internet debates going on 15 years about the whole calories don't count thing, and having seen Lord knows how many people diet over the years. The simple fact is that approach doesn't work. You know, the diets that they will trick people into eating less temporarily, and they'll lose a few pounds, and then that's it. So first and foremost is it has to create a caloric deficit. Now, how much is up to debate? I've written, there's times when moderate deficit diet is appropriate, there's times when extreme deficit diet is appropriate, but the absolute thing that we don't get to argue about is it must create a long-term caloric deficit. So that's number one. Number two is it must provide adequate dietary protein. Again, this is kind of inarguable. And we talked on what's adequate and what's not, and that will depend on the person. It may range, again, from a low of, you know, possibly 0.7 grams per pound of lean body mass. Under one of my diets called the Rapid Fat Loss Handbook, which we can come back, you know, lean individuals maybe need 2 grams per pound of lean body mass, but that's pretty much all they'll be eating. So adequate dietary protein is number two. The third one is it must contain adequate essential fatty acids. Again, those are the fish oils. My general recommendation is between 6 to 10 standard fish oil capsules per day, providing somewhere between 1.8 to 3 grams of active fish oil. And that's the important thing, is the active amount, not the, you know, different fish oils will have slightly different amounts of the active ingredient. The liquid fish oils like Carlson's may have slightly different amounts, but the key is to get that 1.8 to 3 grams of active fish oil. I think we would all agree that eating sufficient amounts of vegetables and fiber is probably going to be a very good thing. Again, fullness, it slows gastric emptying. Beyond that, pretty much all bets are off. Some people do stunningly well on, you know, pretty much filling up the rest of their diet with lots and lots of carbohydrates. They typically are leaner, more insulin sensitive, extremely active, don't have any real stubborn fat depots. Other people may have to go to extremely low carbohydrate diets. This may be an issue of insulin resistance. Low carbohydrates can help shifting stubborn body fat. Women typically have a problem with hip and thigh fat. Lean men, you know, lower back fat tends to be difficult to kind of get rid of. Most people will probably end up sort of somewhere between those two extremes, where they may have sort of moderate carbohydrate amounts and fill up the rest with moderate dietary fat amounts. But basically the caloric deficit, the protein, and essential fatty acids, I think, are the three absolutes. Everything else is really going to depend on the specifics of the situation.
Now, you mentioned the fish oil capsules. Do you think there's a difference between the fish oil capsules you can maybe pick up at the drugstore versus health food store fish oils?
Honestly, no. And I know a lot of people disagree with me very strongly on this one, but at least in the U.S., whenever they've done analysis of all the different fish oil products, there's really never any enormous difference. They all, I mean, even the lower cost stuff, they haven't found any real issues with mercury or PCBs, which has been a long concern. They always contain the appropriate amount of active ingredient, and that's actually what I do. I buy mine in bulk from the local Costco, just the local Kirkland's brand. It's all, whenever I've seen Consumer Reports type companies do testing, it's always come out pretty much the same. So, you know, the one advantage to possibly getting some of the higher concentration fish oils is, you know, some people don't like taking pills, so they do make sort of pharmaceutical level fish oils that contain about double the active ingredient that the cheaper stuff has. For people who don't want to swallow less pills, that may be beneficial. I know a lot of people that like liquids, just again because they don't like swallowing pills and they would rather, you know, put liquid on food or tuna fish or use as a salad dressing. The Carlson's lemon fish oil is pretty tasty stuff. But for the most part, now I say get as long as it's sort of a reputable brand. I don't see any enormous difference.
Okay, that's cool. I think that saved people a little bit of cash.
Yeah.
So I know that you're a fan of higher protein intakes and stuff like that. What are your thoughts on meal frequency? There's been a lot of talk about fasting and things like that lately. What are your thoughts on intermittent fasting to facilitate fat loss?
Honestly, it works extremely well for a lot of people. You know, kind of, let me touch back on meal frequency and then I'll lead into some IFing stuff. There's this idea that still floats around that when you eat more frequently, you stoke the metabolic rate. If you skip breakfast or if you skip a meal, you go into fat hoarding mode. And it's all basically nonsense. When they've done direct studies, and this is when they've kept the calories the same and manipulated meal frequency, there's no difference in metabolic rate. There's no difference, you know, there's no difference in anything for humans. Now in rats, if they skip a meal, their body does shift into fat storing mode or what have you. But rats work on a time frame about 3 to 7 times faster than humans, because they only live like 2 years. So like one day of life for a rat is the equivalent of about 7 days of life for a human being. So a single meal for a rat is like a whole day's eating for a human being. So the research just doesn't pan out. What's actually been found is that if you fast a human for 3 days, his metabolic rate actually goes up for about 5% in the first 3 days, and then starts to come down about day four. So a lot of these ideas that about a higher meal frequency stokes the metabolic rate or limits fat or whatever is basically based on nothing. And if anything, the research says the exact opposite, which isn't to say there aren't benefits for some people. Some research has shown that a higher meal frequency keeps people fuller and they stabilize blood glucose. And don't get me wrong. It clearly that has worked for a lot of people. However, it also can turn people into complete psychopaths. You'll see stories online, people who are on, you know, if you don't eat every 3 hours, your muscles will fall off. And they literally can't function as human beings. They have to go sneak away from their office cubicle to the bathroom to eat their chicken, broccoli, and rice because they're afraid their the metabolic rate's going to fall down or whatever. They won't go out to a movie with a loved one because it would force them to miss a meal, and it really leads to a lot of very dysfunctional eating patterns, which kind of brings me the long way around to intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting, the basic premise is that you lengthen the length of the normal overnight fast from, you know, normally say 8 hours to anywhere from 14 to 16 hours or more, and then eat most of your calories in, I've seen anywhere from one meal. Some people are using larger eating periods of 4 to 6 hours, and we can talk about some of the differences. And while that will have a lot of the high meal frequency people absolutely aghast, the fact is that research is showing some real benefits to that. It turns out that a lot of very good things physiologically, metabolically seem to occur with actually lower meal frequencies in terms of brain health, insulin sensitivity. A lot of research is really identifying a lot of good things coming out of that. From a more practical standpoint, a lot of people I've seen online, and I've played with it myself, find that as much as anything, we can argue the physiological benefits all day long, and whether or not there were any, the freedom that it gives them mentally, getting them off of that you have to eat every 2.5 hours or you will die obsession mentality, it frees them from that and gives them a lot more flexibility. And if it doesn't work better, it certainly works at least as well as typical dieting. For some people, it actually works better. And those folks, one thing I've seen is that smaller individuals, and this is typically women will have this happen and even lighter males, when they're dieting, they don't get to eat a lot of food. You know, a lighter female may be dieting on, say, 1,200 calories a day with activity to get any sort of reasonable fat loss. And no matter how you cut it, that's not a lot of food. Now, if you think you have to eat 6 meals a day, that's a 200-calorie meal, which is a few bites of food, which is hardly satisfying. You know, I typically will maybe recommend cutting that back to, say, 4 meals per day, which is at least a little bit better. But a lot of those folks find that if they intermittent fast and do, say, 2 larger meals during the eating period later in the day, that not only are those meals satisfying, but there's an inherent issue. Being able to eat 2 larger meals that actually feel like a meal is better than starving all day on these tiny little mini meals of 300 calories a day. So it has some huge benefits from that standpoint.
Okay, so that's just it's a really interesting concept. So would you, in that case, use that plan more with specific individuals than others? Like, would you recommend to some people a higher frequency eating pattern and some people a lower frequency or intermittent fasting pattern based on their lifestyle or based on physiological variables?
I'll be honest, I haven't done a whole lot with intermittent fasting myself. You know, I've played with it personally. I haven't really used it a lot with anybody I've worked with. The guy you really want to talk to if you want to find out about intermittent fasting is a guy named Martin Birkin. He runs a website called leangains.com, and he's doing some really incredible things with his clients with intermittent fasting. So I'm pretty much going to throw you to him. He would be a very good interview because he's really done his homework. So I haven't used it a tremendous amount other than just kind of paying attention to what folks are doing. But yeah, if I were going to use it, a lot of it would kind of depend on lifestyle. I have found that it doesn't work well for everybody. My significant other was dieting at one point. She tends not to be able to eat a lot of calories. So we tried it with her. She was one of the folks that really didn't respond well to it. We found with her that she felt pretty good during the fasting period, but when she would have her first meal, kind of her pre-workout meal to break the fast, it tended to make her really sleepy and dopey. So she didn't seem to respond to it particularly well. And I have seen some folks who just didn't handle it well. There's also a potential for some folks that they tend to kind of lose control of their eating, and rather than becoming sort of an intermittent fasting, it almost becomes intermittent binging, where they don't eat anything for 18 hours, and then their eat period, they just start shoveling as much crap down their gullet as they can, and it ends up not really having any effect. So I think there are some behavioral stuff that needs to kind of be taken into account on an individual basis, but I think certainly for folks, for the folks that it works for, it works absolutely stunningly for. But there are some folks that it just doesn't seem to have a whole lot. It doesn't work well or doesn't benefit. So I would tend to look at, when they can train. It does seem to require evening training more often than not. People who train in the mornings have a lot of trouble making it work because it's hard to figure out when the eat period starts and stops and when the fasting period starts and stops. There's some individual personality stuff that seems to kind of factor in, as well as just responses to eating a big meal before a workout. So again, I haven't used it a whole lot, and I would throw it over to Martin Birkin to really get the details of that.
Okay, cool, thanks. Now, with regards to carbohydrates, you mentioned that some people do well with carbohydrates, some people do well with less.
Yes.
Do you have any opinions with regards to carbohydrate timing, like maybe whether you should have it in the morning, evening, post-workout, or sort of zone-esque where they take it broken up over the course of the day?
I've seen all the arguments, and I've looked at – I think they can all work under certain circumstances. One of the common ideas that sort of is out now is to have most of your carbs first thing in the morning after an overnight fast and after training. And kind of the usual logic is that's when insulin sensitivity is the highest. That's when you should have the majority of your carbohydrates and eat lower carbs the rest of the day. That does work very well for a lot of people. I've seen people, I've done it myself, spreading their carbohydrates out throughout the day. That works. Years ago in my first book, The Ketogenic Diet, we found that a lot of people were trying to follow these extremely low-carbohydrate diets, but while trying to do intensive weight training, and it just didn't work. And so we started, there were a multitude of solutions, and one of those was to eat carbs before and after training, which looks very similar to some of the current dietary approaches. And honestly, it all kind of seems to work in the long run. There's certainly a benefit to putting carbs around workout. And I actually did a Q&A last week on my website that the question that comes up a lot, and since I think we're going to talk about summer dieting, is when I'm dieting, should I do a post-workout shake or should I do a pre-workout shake or during workout shake? People get concerned, will it slow my fat loss? Will it decrease the growth hormone response? Whatever the rationale is. And my general answer is that yes, I do think people should maintain some sort of around workout nutrition to improve, recovery and adaptation and et cetera. We can come back to that question. So on a diet, yes, working sort of backwards, you should have some carbs around training, especially more high. I'm talking about high intensity training. Clearly, if you walk on the treadmill, you don't need to eat too much carbohydrates. But if you're in the weight room or doing high intensity type metabolic work, I think some carbs should be placed around workout. Now, how you divide those up the rest of the day, a lot of that will depend on how many you have to play with. If you've only got 50 carbs a day, then you probably want to put those around your workout and eat mostly low carb the rest of the day. If you're one of the people who can diet on higher carbohydrates, that gives you a whole lot more flexibility. So you might place them some first around your workout, some first thing in the morning, and then you can spread out whatever you have left throughout the rest of the day. And clearly, as carbohydrate intake goes up, they're going to end up being sort of subdivided into the other meals a little bit more evenly after you fulfill, you know, the around workout requirements and anything else. So again, a lot of it would sort of depend on specific context. Some people I do find, you know, again, eating carbs makes them want to eat more carbs. So in that situation, you tend to end up with a little bit more restrictive type meals where if you give them some carbs at that meal, they're just going to want more. So you end up having to subdivide it out a little bit more. So a lot of it really, people hate hearing this from me, but it depends. You know, I've never found any single diet that worked for every single person, and I've never found any single dietary approach that was vastly superior for everyone across the board. So there tends to be a lot of, there's some of it's trial and error, and some of it's just factoring in with what the person is actually doing in their training or in their life.
Obviously, this kind of the it depends approach is pretty much the standard. Nobody wants to do a cookie cutter plan.
Yeah.
But if you had to put together like a step-by-step approach for the average listener here who is just like, okay, I just need to get cut for summer. Give me
right.
some basic guidelines so I could get started. What specifics could you give them to sort of get moving, I guess?
Okay, this is my generic one size fits all kind of diet. Step one, set calories. The typical value I use as a starting point is 10 to 12 calories per pound, which is about 22 to 26 calories per kilogram. Someone will have to check my math on that since I tend not to think in metric. So that's the starting point for fat loss. And again, we're assuming relatively lean individuals. Protein, somewhere between 1 and 1.5 grams per pound of lean body mass. Dietary fat, I have not generally found that extremely low-fat diets, people tend to just be hungry and miserable and not stick with them very well. So my kind of default fat intake as a starting point, 20 to 25% of total calories. So that would be roughly, say, 0.33 grams of fat per pound, again, as sort of a starting point. And then the rest of the diet would be carbs, whatever that works out to. So multiply your weight by 10 to 12, figure out your protein, set your dietary fat, figure out the rest with carbs, done. That would be my sort of generic stock standard baseline fat loss diet. And it would end up being moderate protein, low to moderate carbs, low to moderate dietary fat. I think for the average person, that would be a plenty sufficient starting point.
Okay, now, what are your thoughts with, I find that your thoughts with regards to cheat meals and refeeds are particularly interesting because they seem to vary based on body fat percentage and,
yes.
and activity level. So can you maybe break that down a little bit?
Okay, for some definitions, so people know what we're talking about. For a free meal, and this goes back to one of the tangents I went off on about, you know, why diets fail. And one, at least along with the hunger issue, at least another reason is let's say I told someone that they could never eat, whatever, pizza for the rest of their life. Automatically, they're going to want to have a piece of pizza. This is just standard human nature. We want what we can't have, completely normal. Diets that never allow any sort of flexibility or chance to go off of them tend to have, in my experience, poor long-term adherence. Now, they may work stunningly in the short term. You know, again, bodybuilders have proven that being extremely focused for 16 weeks works absolutely fantastically. What you don't usually hear about is the month-long food binges that most bodybuilders go on after the contest. When they've been restricted and have not eaten anything that tasted good for 16 weeks, they tend to go absolutely crazy when it's over. And there's some true horror stories of just ludicrous body fat gains and body weight gains. So everyone goes, ah, they look so great the day of the show. Yeah, well, look at what happened the month after. So I'm a big believer in giving people breaks on the diet, and those come in three categories, the first of which is a free meal. A free meal is simply a meal that's not a diet-based meal. So if you're on a completely low-carbohydrate diet, odds are you're going to be craving bread, you're going to be craving starch, you're going to be craving all the things that you've been told that you can never eat again because those foods are evil. I tell people to, again, depending on their body fat percentage, to have one, possibly two meals a week where they go and they eat something that is not on their diet. And this is mainly for psychological reasons. It's simply to give them a little bit of a mental break from feeling deprived, from feeling restricted, but it does so under a very controlled set of circumstances. So it's not an issue of they had a little bit of the forbidden food, they felt guilty, they felt terrible, so they decided they were going to eat the entire box of it. Usually that happens with cookies more than pasta, but the kind of the point is made. That's typically the mindset that happens with dieters, is if they're not perfect, they've had even the smallest amount of forbidden food, their diet's ruined, and it just leads them into this whole poor psychological set of things. So I recommend people have these free meals. I recommend that they're eaten out with friends, you know, under sort of more controlled circumstances. Odds are at a restaurant, you're not going to get three desserts, whereas if you get something at the grocery store, you may sit at home and eat the entire thing because there's nobody around. It also allows people to actually have a social life. You know, there's nothing worse, and I've done it, and you've probably done it, going out with a bunch of friends, and they're having fun and having a couple beers or having chicken, or whatever it is, and you're like, well, I'm dieting, so I'm going to have lean chicken breast dipped in water and some steamed vegetables. That's really depressing and miserable, and it's not very much fun. So I recommend folks have free meals, typically one to two a week, depending on body fat percentage. Typically, as body fat percentage goes down, I find that people need to actually break their diets more frequently, which you want to get into the metabolic stuff, we can, and sort of the physiological rationale. And it's typically as folks are carrying more body fat, they don't have to as much. So that's the free meal concept. I do want to emphasize, just kind of tangentially, a lot of people call this a cheat meal, and I really recommend they don't. There's this mentality with calling it a cheat that there's just this negative connotation because of the wording. And I find that when people think in terms of a cheat meal or a cheat day or what have you, they almost go out of their way to eat the worst stuff they can, whether they even want it or not. And you'll see folks, you know, literally eating themselves sick with stuff they don't even want to eat. But the idea is, I'm cheating. It's supposed to be bad. I'm going to go out of my way to eat as much crap as I can. So I prefer to call it a free meal. It sounds like a semantic distinction, but I find that it's actually not. So the next level up from a free meal is something that I call a refeed. And some of your listeners may be familiar with the idea of cyclical diets. You know, the anabolic diet was one by Mara DePasquale, Dan Duchesne's Body Opus. I've done my own version called the Ultimate Diet 2.0. These are all diets that tend to alternate periods of very strict, typically low-carbohydrate dieting with periods of high-carbohydrate and sometimes high-fat overfeeding. Now, when I use the term refeed, I tend to be very specific that it's a high-carbohydrate, moderate protein, relatively low-fat period. And I've just found that works better than eating a lot of dietary fat. And those phases can last anywhere from 5 hours up to, in some cases, 24 hours up to 48 to 72 hours, depending on the specifics of the situation.
I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Yeah.
Does that vary then based on the leanness of the individual as well?
Yes, very much so. And again, there's the recurring theme is typically as people get leaner, they need to have longer and or more frequent breaks in the diet. And the basic reason is the body fights back when we diet. There's a number of metabolic adaptations with hormones, leptin, ghrelin, insulin. There's a whole bunch of them where metabolic rate starts to slow down, muscle loss often accelerates. All these things start to go south metabolically, and breaking the diet by having these deliberate periods of high-carb, high-calorie overfeeding helps to reverse those adaptations. So as counterintuitive as this seems, as people get leaner, I find they have to break their diets more frequently, again, with either longer periods of carbohydrate overfeeding or more frequent periods. And as people are carrying more body fat, there tends not to be quite the level of the body fighting back, so they don't need them as frequently. So to put this in sort of some real-world perspective, let's say you have a male dieting and he's at 25% body fat. He may only need to do a refeed every 10 to 14 days. There's generally not an enormous amount of metabolic adaptation going on. and 5 hours of high carb overfeeding, you know, might be as often as every week, might be every 10 to 14 days, is usually sufficient. By the time someone's down, male is at, say, 15% body fat, you may be up to 12 hours once a week. By the time someone is single digits and going lower, I've done things where I've had people refeeding 5 to 12 hours, you know, every fifth day. I've had diets where they may only diet 3 to 4 days in a row and then do a 48-hour refeed. A lot of it depends on how they're training and the specifics of the situation. But as they get leaner, you find that these things have to happen much more frequently. And these schemas are presented primarily in a book I wrote that I wish more people would read called The Guide to Flexible Dieting. It has all the different recommendations for refeeds. So, yes, as people get leaner and the body starts to fight back much, much harder, I find that inserting the refeeds, either making them larger, more frequent, or sometimes both, becomes necessary to keep the fat loss moving.
Okay, and you had a third category as well,
yes,
correct?
The third category is something I call the full diet break, which is something that I really wish more people would do, and very few, at least in the U.S., really it ever occurs to them. And the idea, the premise for this is that I find most people diet for too long without a break. And again, some of this is mental, but some of this is definitely physiological. And going back to someone carrying a lot of body fat, it's not unheard of for extremely overweight individuals to lose 50 to 100 pounds or more of body fat. Now, if we're assuming, say, 1 to 2 pounds a week, which is sort of the stock standard generic recommendation, you're telling this person they're going to have to diet for 50 to 100 weeks straight. I can understand why a lot don't bother. The mental pressure to feel deprived and probably hungry for that long of a period is overwhelming. And mentally, I think people simply crack up. Even when you get to leaner individuals, there's just this mentality of dieting just forever without ever taking a mental or a physical break. And a lot of, you know, and people clearly have made it work. Again, bodybuilders do it, but then look at what happens afterwards. Not to mention all the metabolic adaptations, which is just a long way of bringing. So I actually recommend people break their diets up into shorter, more manageable blocks. And it's, again, it's physiological partially, and it's psychological. Is if I tell you have to diet for 100 weeks straight, you're going to go, forget it, I'm not interested, and you're going to never bother. If I say, well, let's diet for 8 weeks, and then we'll stabilize you there, and then diet 8 more weeks, and then we're going to stabilize you there, breaking it up into those smaller blocks, I find, is much less psychologically daunting for a lot of people. Metabolically, you also find that a lot of these adaptations can be at least somewhat reversed. A lot of the things the body is doing to fight back while you're dieting can be reversed during the diet break. Okay, so what's a full diet break? The basic idea is that you simply go back to roughly maintenance calories while maintaining your activity. And I do like to, this is one place where I do mandate that you do need to have a certain number of carbohydrates in the full diet break for it to work optimally. And this has to do with upregulating thyroid hormone, which typically goes down. So I like to see a minimum of, say, 120 to 150 grams of carbs per day. That can go higher. Now, the key with the diet break is that you don't go from dieting and eating lots of lean protein and vegetables and fatty acids to, you don't go back to what you were doing before. Clearly, that doesn't really accomplish anything useful. What I recommend people do to the best of their ability is to maintain the good dieting habits they've been building over the past 4, 6, 8 weeks, depending on body fat percentage, but they get to add back to that. So again, say they've been on your basic diet, lots of lean protein, vegetables, fruits, moderate dietary fat. During the diet break, they can add foods back to bring calories back up. That wouldn't sort of otherwise normally be allowed while they were strictly dieting. Of course, calories are going to come back up towards maintenance. They do that for, say, a 10 to 14 day period. This gives them a mental break from dieting. This gives them a physiological break from dieting. Then they can go do another 6 to 8 week diet phase, bring the weight, body fat percentage down a little bit more, take another diet break, rinse and repeat until they get to where they want to be.
So do you find that that the diet break, although it gives them a physiological change, the psychological effect of adding more food, it's harder to reduce it back down?
Well, that's what's interesting. I'd already had this this idea, and I certainly wasn't the first one to ever come up with it, but there was this really interesting study that came out, it must have been over a decade ago, and what actually the researchers were trying to look at was what happens when people go off their diet. This was the goal of the study, just behaviorally and all of this other stuff. So they took a group of people, and they dieted them fairly hard for, as I recall, maybe 6 weeks. And they told them, okay, for 2 weeks we want you to go off your diet. And they wanted to see what would happen. How much weight would they regain? Would they start eating completely out of control? And then they brought them back in. And what they found was exactly the opposite of what they hoped to find. And the study was basically a complete failure, because all that happened was the people sort of went off their diet, they gained back a pound or two, and they had absolutely no problems returning to the diet when they were done. And the researchers posited that the reason for this was that the diet break was not seen by the dieters as a loss of control. And this brings me, this is something I mentioned earlier in this interview, which is I try to sort of plan these breaks, plan the refeeds, plan the free meals, plan the diet breaks, so that rather than the diet controlling the dieter, rather than the diet controlling the dieter is in control of the diet. Simply meaning that what typically happens is someone that thinking they have to be perfect on their diet goes a little bit off, they feel guilty, they figure the diet is ruined, they might as well eat the bag of cookies, go to McDonald's and get the super large french fries, and they just spiral down. Whereas if it's part of the plan, there seems to be, you don't see that kind of loss of control. And this is what the researchers found with this weird study, is that they thought that by telling the dieters, we want you to take 2 weeks off your diet, the dieters saw it as just part of the overall study design. They saw it as part of what they were doing. So there wasn't this huge loss of control. There wasn't this huge feeling of just psychological trauma and guilt. And they didn't seem to have any real issue going back to the diet when the break was over.
That sounds good. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, now I haven't seen this universally. Some people do really lose control on diet breaks and refeeds, and there are definitely, there's individual circumstances where they don't seem to work. And I suspect this is tying with other psychological aspects of dieting. There's some people that are called disinhibited eaters, and they tend to be real good when they're on the diet, and when under certain circumstances they become disinhibited and kind of lose control of their eating. And there are certain situations where these types of things don't work universally. But on the whole, I find that the majority seems to really benefit from them. And I mentioned this book of mine, A Guide to Flexible Dieting, that it's probably the one that people have really paid the least attention to. I think it's a terrible title, and it's not extreme enough. People always want harder, extremer, more types of diet books, and it's kind of a very more of a behavioral guide to these. But the people to sort of these flexible dieting strategies, the people who have read it have really reported that just the mental anguish that it removed from their diet, realizing that they could have a couple breaks a week in the form of these free meals, or they could actually have these refeed periods or diet breaks, It removed all of this psychological, again, this anguish that tends to come along with these really extreme long-term diets, and gave them a lot more freedom and ability. That there's always a light at the tunnel. Like with the free meals, you've never got more than 3 or 4 days, so you get to eat at least something that's not on your diet. With the refeeds, it could be up to 2 weeks. You know, with a diet break, you at least have a couple weeks where you can maybe plan it around a vacation, plan it around a time. You know, the holidays are always rough for people, where you can schedule these full diet breaks along with that and actually get to live a normal life without completely destroying the progress that you're trying to make with your fat loss goals.
That's awesome. That's especially over Christmas or any major holidays, that would definitely be beneficial for sure.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit. I know some of our listeners today are probably, I'm sure they span the gamut. So we have people who want to lose 20, 30, 40 pounds. And then we probably got a few people who are stuck with like the last 10 stubborn pounds of like body fat that's just clinging to their midsection. Like, what can you do about dropping that last stubborn, you know, few pounds that just won't go away?
Okay, there's two different issues that I'm gonna talk about with the whole stubborn fat thing, And because people tend to use those terms to refer to sort of different things. Most people talk about the last stubborn 10 pounds as just, as I've mentioned throughout the interview, you know, the body fights back when we diet. And this has been known for decades, and recent research is starting to figure out sort of the mechanisms why. And, you know, metabolic rate tends to slow down as you get much, much leaner. And it becomes harder to mobilize fat out of the fat cells. And people just get sick of dieting. And losing that last bit of weight does become difficult. And to at least to a first degree, some of it is simply patience. A lot of it is simply sticking with what you're doing and also realizing that as you get leaner and as you lose weight, you often have to cut things back dietary-wise even more, increase activity to offset some of the adaptation. So that's kind of a general commentary. I think what you're asking about is a book I did last year that sort of culminated a 10-year project of mine called The Stubborn Fat Solution. And what most people have realized, most people tend to have sort of these stubborn fat areas. And for males, it's typically the ab area, especially lower abs, often low back is a real problem. Women, it's typically hips and thighs. And these are the areas that are always just the last ones to come off. And you know, women traditionally have had the absolute worst times with reducing lower body fat. And it's not uncommon at all to see women who just have absolutely shredded upper bodies. Just they've got a six-pack men would kill for. They've got striations in their delts. They're just a walking anatomy map from the waist up. And then from the waist down, you wouldn't think they trained. And that's a real common thing, and has been a big problem for female physique competitors for years and years and years. Men, again, typically have problems with kind of the lower abdominal area, lower back area tends to be the last ones to go, although it will typically go if men will just be more patient. And it turns out that that the fat cells in the body are not all the same. And they tend to differ in a whole lot of different ways in terms of how they respond to the hormone insulin, how they respond to the fat mobilizing hormones, adrenaline and noradrenaline, what types of fat they store, receptor. There's a whole bunch of differences. And if you take fat cells from different parts of the body, you'll see that they're actually acting differently. And this goes a lot of the way to explain sort of these stubborn fat areas. Now, I should note that there are some people who are really lucky that they tend to carry fat very evenly and they don't have any of these stubborn areas, and they're probably not listening to this interview because since they don't ever have any real problems, they just don't ever need to worry about trying to find solutions. Generally, people who have any type of stubborn fat areas are the ones that are kind of constantly tossing about for these different solutions. In any event, so I wrote this book called The Stubborn Fat Solution where I looked at all of these details and how fat is mobilized and how fat is stored and all of the physiological differences between the stubborn fat areas and the less stubborn fat areas, and looking at all the different reasons that differentiate stubborn from non-stubborn, developed a series of protocols that help people get rid of these. And some of it's supplements, some of it's training, some of it's diet. I mentioned earlier on that a lot of people find that simply lowering carbohydrates tends to help with stubborn fat mobilization. And sort of the detailed reason is stubborn fat cells have a type of receptor called, your listeners may have heard of mention of an alpha-2 adrenal receptor. And it's basically a receptor that binds adrenaline and noradrenaline, and it inhibits fat mobilization. So you're exercising, you're releasing these hormones that should mobilize fat, and these certain types of fat cells actually get a signal that inhibits fat loss. And as it turns out, like hip and thigh fat has way more of these alpha receptors than other types of fat, and men's low back fat tends to have more of these things. So a lot of the standard training protocols don't really mobilize fat out of this area well. Well, as it turns out, if you lower carbohydrates extremely for 4 days, this has this naturally inhibiting effect on these alpha receptors. And kind of going back to a much earlier question about what kinds of diets work for certain people is people with stubborn fat depots often find that very low carbohydrate diets help shift those. The problem being that not everyone responds well to extremely low carbohydrate diets. They get depressed, they can't train, they don't work well. So there's other strategies outlined in this book, again, some specific training protocols, specific supplement protocols that help to overcome this stubbornness to mobilization and loss.
Now, I know there's different different schools of thought with regards to which hormones affect fat storage in different areas. And
yes.
One school of thought suggests that abdominal fat has to do with cortisol, the hip fat and lower back fat, kind of as it wraps around the love handle area, has to do with insulin, and your thigh and glute fat would be related to estrogen.
Right.
What are your thoughts in that regard?
Yeah, you know, I've, for a solid decade, I looked at all the research on these different fat depots and what was determining it. And for the most part, I've seen that there is some truth to it, of course. The abdominal fat and cortisol is a little bit being misrepresented. There's a type of fat called visceral fat, which is actually deep within the gut and surrounds the organs. And that is definitely related to excessive cortisol levels. Abdominal fat per se, the stuff that sort of covers the six packs that most people are focused on, I haven't seen a whole lot linking cortisol to that specifically. I've never come across anything linking insulin resistance to the supraeuculi site, the side of the love handles. There is some, you know, there's certainly, you know, women typically have the lower body fat problem, so there's a certain logic to blaming estrogen for that. Bodybuilders for decades used anti-estrogens, and at best they had sort of a minimal effect. So while hormones are clearly part of it, more of what I've seen has to do with sort of how these fat cells develop at puberty and how they develop as far as the adrenal receptors and things of that nature. So I personally haven't seen lots of research to support that. I know a lot of people saying that it isn't. If they've got it, I'd love for them to send it to me, but I personally haven't seen a whole lot to support the idea.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to, with regards to training protocols, is there anything that you think specifically that people need to do when it comes to fat loss?
Are we talking about weight training, cardio training, or both?
Sort of as a overall summary of both, I guess.
I guess the main thing I would say is, you know, that there's exercise is kind of often heralded as this fat loss, this amazing weight loss, fat loss solution. And the realities tend to be very different. You know, we can all prove this to ourselves. Go into the gym and you can see people toiling day in, day out at various kinds of exercise programs without losing a pound. And without some sort of dietary modification, the reality is that very little tends to happen. And even the studies that have shown that exercise causes some fat loss, it's generally pretty moderate amounts. So the first thing I really think people need to realize is that diet tends to have a much more profound impact on overall fat loss than training per se. And a lot of this is just simply, it's just simple reality. The amount of activity that calories that most people can burn with exercise really isn't that large unless they're exceedingly well trained. And if they're exceedingly well trained, they probably don't need to lose a lot of fat in the first place. So the reality is that most fat loss is going to come from diet, some type of slight to moderate caloric restriction, et cetera, which isn't to say that exercise doesn't clearly play a role or have an enormous benefit. At least, probably the major benefit has to do with sparing muscle mass loss. And we've known for 3 or 4 decades that if you just diet, even if you've got plenty of dietary protein and everything else, there's always some loss of lean body mass, active muscle tissue, some of it's connective tissue, and that's generally a bad thing. And adding activity spares lean body mass loss, which also means that for a given amount of weight loss, the fat loss will be greater. So exercise should be added to almost any dietary approach for that, you know, if for no other reason than that. And there's been lots of debate and argument, you know, is cardio better than weight training? And pretty much universally, weight training tends to be superior. So I would tend to say that from a fat loss perspective, if someone had to pick, you know, one type of activity to help with their fat loss efforts, it would probably be to reduce their calories and lift weights. And that approach has worked extremely well for several decades. You know, some folks can even get contest, you know, single-digit body fat with nothing but reducing calories and some type of weight training, although that's not universal. So that brings up a question, sort of, you know, what's the best kind of weight training? And I'm actually in the process of writing a series of articles for the website on this. But in general, I would say if someone had to pick one type of weight training on a diet, I would prefer it to be low volume, high intensity, you know, with heavy weights, simply because I feel that that tends to be best for maintaining muscle mass. You know, basically lift weights to maintain the muscle, use the diet and or cardio to generate the fat loss, stop worrying about it. Now, there are certain metabolic types of weight training, you know, they're out there under various names. Turbulence training by Craig Ballantyne, Afterburn by Alwyn Cosgrove. There's all kinds of approaches out there. These can help with fat loss, but I tend to use them only in conjunction with some sort of heavy weight training. Again, I think you need the heavy weight training to maintain the muscle mass, and then the metabolic stuff can kind of be added to that if there's time and energy. From a cardio standpoint, lately the internet has kind of divided itself into this huge, these two different camps. You know, traditionally people have done a lot of kind of low intensity, steady state cardio. There's also an argument made for interval training where you alternate periods of high intensity and low intensity exercise. And there's, as with everything, there's kind of pros and cons to both. You know, intervals have their advantages in terms of it tends to be more time efficient, it tends to deplete muscle glycogen, there's a nice hormonal response. The problem is that they tend to be harder to recover from. I find a lot of people are trying to combine heavy weight training, metabolic weight training, intervals on a low carbohydrate diet, and they wonder why their legs are tired all the time. And it's because you can only recover from so much in a given week. And I'm sure you've found this with either athletes or fat loss people. There's just only so much you can do on a calorie-restricted diet. And something has to give, and I find that it's usually the training. And people are tending to overtrain by trying to combine all the high-intensity modalities together. So with intervals versus low-intensity cardio, again, I think both have their place. You know, in my experience, most dieters tend to do something activity-wise almost daily, whether it's to burn some more calories or for whatever reason. And you can't do intervals 7 days a week, especially if you're trying to lift weights heavy 3 or 4 days a week and do metabolic weight training 3 or 4 days a week. And something has to give. So when it comes to sort of activity, again, I sort of tend to fill up the slots depending on the specifics. So first you need to do at least a couple of heavy weight training sessions a week to maintain muscle mass. If you're so inclined, you can add some metabolic weight training and some high rep short rest interval stuff. If you're going to do cardio, I think a balance of low intensity stuff and interval work is probably better than kind of either extreme. But again, it depends on the specifics. You know, untrained individuals tend not to do particularly well with intervals because they just don't have the training background to go super hard on it. I know a lot of people tend to like to use them because, again, they're time efficient and they're less boring than walking on the treadmill. But again, I think finding some balance is probably better for everybody. So a lot of it's the specific of the situation, specific of the dieter, but the general idea of, I think, a balance of the different types of things tends to work better than kind of any extreme.
Okay, that's, I think with most things, there's always extreme camps, and the true answer lies somewhere in the middle, right?
I don't think you could say it any better than that. You know, people tend to want kind of a single easy answer, and I find they get really frustrated with me a lot because they ask a question and I ask 8 different context questions to give them a better answer. But invariably, when you've got 2 opposing extreme viewpoints, absolutely, the truth is almost always somewhere in the middle.
So I know you're a busy guy, so I'm going to let you go and we're going to wrap this up. Is there any closing points you'd like to say with regards to fat loss, or any final tips you want to impart on our readers before we wrap up?
Nothing really comes to mind. You know, I think what I do find some people, nothing comes to mind, honestly. Well, what I was going to say is I've occasionally found folks that what happens is people, I think right now, are very overwhelmed by the amount of information out there. Everyone seems to have, you know, the perfect diet, the best diet, the solution, and they all seem to contradict one another on some level. And I think people often get so confused, they almost get paralyzed by the overload of information that's out there. And what I would entreat people to keep in mind is that, as I brought up earlier, people have gotten lean, ripped, cut, lost weight on a zillion different approaches. And what I've found, and this tends to sort of guide a lot of my philosophy and the way I approach things, is A, there's no single approach that works for every single person. You know, invariably, any diet you find, and this includes mine, this includes any diet book, you'll find people that just report stunning results, and you'll find people that report absolutely horrible results. Now, of course, most diet books will only tell you about their success stories. I actually tend to focus on the failures, because I find that when people, when one of my diets, one of my things, something I write doesn't work for someone, I want to find out why, because assuming they did what I asked them, I want to know the reason why something that should have worked didn't work, because that tends to help me develop my model of training and diet theory better. It is, when people succeed on stuff, you never know if they succeeded because of or in spite of you, but when somebody fails on something you wrote, you've got a real opportunity to learn why it didn't work and maybe manipulate your model and add a new data point. So, but my point is that people who found something that really works for them may have lucked into the diet that was right for their psychological background, their physiological background, their training background, and the people who didn't probably didn't. Rather, but getting back to my point, the fact that all these different approaches clearly have worked for people points out that it's not the specifics of the diet. It's the commonalities. And I think if you look at all successful fat loss diets, fat loss training programs, anything that works for at least some population, they all tend to share the same set of commonalities. And again, that tends to be they create some sort of deficit over an extended period, they provide adequate essential nutrients, there's a training program involved. If people would focus more on the commonalities and less on the details, I think they'd realize there's a lot less difference in the approaches. And then picking the approach is more about finding what's appropriate, again, for their physiology, what type of training they're doing, their life schedule, things of that nature, than trying to find, you know, pick the perfect diet for them. If they'll focus on the generalities rather than the specifics, I think that goes a whole lot further than getting themselves tied up about finding the best single approach, because it just doesn't exist.
That's a really great point. So where can people learn more about you if they want to follow up or read more of your material?
Best place is just the main website, which is at www.bodyrecomposition, that's BodyRecomposition.com, or they can just go to lylemcdonald.com, again, one word, which is probably faster, and that'll redirect. And that's got all my current articles, access to the books. I have a forum that I check on daily. People can ask questions about the different products or just ask, get my opinion about stuff. So that would be or they can just Google my name, and I'm all over the web in various and sundry places. So.
Great. So I just want to thank you for all the great material today, and hopefully we'll do this again.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thanks a lot.